This is a continuation of, this is actually, we're in Parshat Miketz this week, but this is a continuation of Vayeshev. And of course, the overview of this week and last week's Torah portions are roughly the same. We're in the story of Joseph. Joseph has already been sold down to Egypt, and he has been, he's about to be elevated by the Pharaoh for interpreting Pharaoh's dreams about the famine. And of course, this week's Torah portion, Miketz, is the story of the famine in Egypt. And because Joseph, in his dream, knew that there would be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine, one of the interesting things is he is rewarded not specifically for interpreting the dream, but rather for being a politically shrewd individual. So he says to Pharaoh, there's seven fat cows and they're eaten by seven skinny cows. And Pharaoh goes, oh no, what are we going to do? And at that point, Joseph says, I know what we're going to do. We're going to build storehouses. And in those storehouses, we'll stock up on grain from the seven good years. And Pharaoh goes, you are a really smart guy. Why don't I put you on my staff, right? Which is a fascinating thing. And then the important part of the story for narrative purposes, which is both this week's and next week's Torah portion, is that Joseph's brothers, who sold him into slavery, who told their father that he was dead, and who were brutally jealous of him throughout his life, have been told by their father, we have a famine here. I hear there's a dude down in Egypt giving out free food. Go get some, right? I wasn't thinking about this, but it just jumped to mind that we are at that literal phase in America right now where we had a booming economy in this country for basically the last 10 years, roughly 9 years. And then we came into coronavirus, and now there are food pantry lines that are miles long. And I have talked about food insecurity right now repeatedly in this class, but it seems like we as a country are kind of coming to reckon with the seven fat years and the seven skinny years in a big way. God willing, may it be your will, Hashem Yisborach, that this not be 7 years of skinny cows, but that we get through this and bounce back quickly. And that those who are struggling be cared for by those who are fat cows like me. Okay. Rana's asking if anyone's accepting actual canned goods. My understanding is no. Get a check. Make a check. Click a website. Click the donate button. Give money. I know it's not as nice. I have cans of corn that have been sitting here for months that I wanted to give away, and I can't. So Judy, do you want to say something?
Yeah, right. I'm giving to the Pittsburgh Food Pantry. I'm also giving to Feed America. The biggest donation will be to the Pittsburgh Food Pantry because I'm now living in Pittsburgh. And then I'm giving half that amount to the Kosher Food Pantry because it's a kosher food. You probably all know that, but I'm a newbie. So this was my daughter Amy told me about it. And then Feed America is a national group. Passing that on.
Why don't you turn it off, Iggy? That's great. I'm going to add one more additional thing, which is so this was an interview that was on NPR just the other day. For every dollar given to a food bank, or I think that's given away by a food bank for food, $9 are spent by people who are on the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is used to be called food stamps. And the number one Jewish organization that is working on food scarcity issues is called Mazon, M-A-Z-O-N. They're a national organization. In addition to trying to get food into people's pantries, they also are working on the political end to deal with food insecurity. So I think that's really important. All right. But that's kind of the overview. And then we're going to move into the text. So our text for today is, I will share the screen with you. is popping up right now. It's also in the chat for those of you who came on time. And it's also in the email if you need that email. So the text says, Vayhi kahayom hazeh vayavo habayta la'asot melachto ve'ein ish me'anshe habayt sham babayt. So this is... Iggy, can you plug it in? Thanks. We're working two on the desk together. So one of the moments in the story that we have, I'll actually go into another room, make it easier on my son. So one of the other stories, important parts of our story, is backwards, where Joseph is in Potiphar's wife's house, and he is a servant to Potiphar's wife, and he is in a compromising situation where Potiphar's wife has a crush on him, and yet he needs to not poop where he eats, as they say, and tick off the master by having a little something-something on the side with the master's wife. So that's the story that we're about to tell. One such day, he came into the house to do his work. So the Hebrew here is la'asot malachto, which is going to be important. V'tit pesehu bebigdo le'mor shichva imi v'yazov bigdo b'yada v'yinas v'yetze hachutza. She caught him by hold of his garment and said, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand, and he got away and fled outside. So the question that kind of comes up here and that Rashi comments on is what stops him from lying with Potiphar's wife, right? And so Rashi's comment is, a vision resembling his father's countenance appeared, to which I point out that this is the fuller comment by Rashi is this down below. So on the word to do his work, it says that in the Talmud, Rab and Shmuel differ as to what this means. One holds that it means that he came in to literally do actual housework. And the other says that he came into the house, you know, with air quotes, to do his work, meaning he came into the house because he knew Potiphar's wife was in there. She was looking pretty good, and he knew that she had a crush on him. So he was giving in to his lower instincts so that he should have a little fling with the boss's wife, right? So two rabbis of the Talmud, one says to do his work is to be understood literally, and one thinks it's to be meant figuratively. But the rest of the story that Shmuel is telling is the following. But a vision of his father's face appeared to him, and he resisted temptation and did not sin. And this is all from Talmud Sota 36b. So this is a Rashi comment that is taken from the Talmud. The Rashi comment being that to do his work means that his father appeared, that he wanted to sin, he wanted to give in to his lower instincts, but in the end he decided to, he had a vision of his father. And his father's face kind of appeared to him, like Yoda or Obi-Wan Kenobi in the Star Wars movies, and kind of encouraged him to not sin, which is really interesting. Okay, so what are our commentators, our Hasidic commentators, going to do with this? So Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch, who was the son of the Baal Shem Tov, is going to riff basically on this idea of the vision of the father. That's it, right? So far, if you're scoring at home, we're not really interested in the story of Joseph. We're actually interested in this comment that Shmuel, the rabbi, the Talmudic rabbi, gave, which is the question, essentially, why is a person's father appearing helpful in changing their behavior? Which I think is a really interesting question. He says, a person came from one of the blossoms of the Hasidim, the Pirchei Hasidim. So the Pirkei Hasidim are the sprouts of the Hasidim, or the blossoms of the Hasidim. And the blossoms of the Hasidim are, another word saying, kind of like future rabbis, potentially, but they also could be understood as kind of like righteous individuals in education, in process, right? The cadets. Okay, so the cadets of the Hasidim, and he requested to learn. And the question that he asked in learning was, how does one flip to becoming a tzaddik? So the word that's literally used in the Hebrew is lahafech, which is kind of to change, but it literally translates as to flip, to turn over. So Rabbi Tzvi, who is the son of the Baal Shem Tov, right, said the following, with great humility. There are two wealthy persons in our city of Pinsk. One inherited his money from earlier. His father passed along to him a great fortune. The second arrived at his status of wealth by his fingers. He labored and sweated to earn every penny. One day, a person came and asked the inheritor, "How do I become rich?" He answered, "I have no idea. My father passed down to me tens of thousands of rubles." He asked the man that grew up poor and lacked everything at first, and enriched himself by his own efforts, thinking, "He surely knows the secret." So that's, by the way, the end of that story. It doesn't end in the way that I would have wanted it to, in the sense that I would have assumed he would have actually gone to the guy and the guy would have told him the secret. Instead, the story ends suddenly, and we don't get the secret of how a person makes a lot of money. All we learn in the story, by the way, is that you don't go to a person who inherits money for business secrets. You go to a person who worked hard and developed them. So I think that's to our question before about feeling good about our hard work. But that's kind of the beginning. Then there's this last piece where it's Rabbi Hirsch explaining how this applies in his situation. He says, "Thus am I," explained Rabbi Hirsch. "My father, the Baal Shem Tov, also known as the Besht, maintained for me a loftily elevated soul and passed down to me his spiritual treasures. Better you should ask Rabbi Aaron of Karlin, for at first he was a man without inheritance, and with enough work he became a rabbi that earned great heights and has arrived at where he has arrived." Which I love that the way that that's phrased at the end. But I think a lot of you are smiling because I think this is such an interesting text because it's so far afield from where it originally starts, right? The original story is about Yosef possibly having hanky-panky with the boss's wife. We're not interested in that at all. We're interested in how a good person becomes better at their task. And the answer is you find someone who got good by working hard and you ask them the secret. You do not ask a wealthy inheritor how they did it. And this even applies in spiritual matters. And I think that's the really cool piece of this text, right? This applies in spiritual matters. You don't go to the son of the Baal Shem Tov and ask him how to become more spiritually higher or pure. I think similarly, asking a person who grew up ultra-religious and ultra-educated about how to go from being uneducated and unreligious to religious is difficult. I think there's another microcosm to kind of play this one out, which is to say the spiritual work of becoming holy, of raising ourselves up, of becoming morally better individuals is intricately involved in doing the work and in talking to other people who have done the work. It is not ideal to go to someone who is constantly saintly and holy, right? To this end, I think one might make the illusion that going to the Dalai Lama for spiritual wisdom is probably not the best way to go. I mean, I don't know that I would gain much from meeting with the Dalai Lama. I would like to, but he has been a spiritual practitioner on such a higher level than me for so long that I don't know that I'm ready to achieve the levels that he would be able to pass down to me. I would be better served by going to someone who is at a lower madriga. Now, that being said, it's a bit of a challenge to say that that's the way it should be, because that invariably means that the people at the highest spiritual plane should only be ministering to people one notch below them, right? That the Pope should only be working with archbishops. The archbishop should only be working with the bishops with the priests, and the priests with the people. And artificially sealing off the top from the quote-unquote bottom is problematic. The other thing is, and I think that the text even reflects on this, is to say, who can say that the Pope is actually the spiritually most enlightened within the Christian world? It is entirely likely that there are those who are more spiritually elevated and are incredible spiritual holy beings who have not been selected by the church bureaucracy with the cool and fancy titles. The same applies in Judaism, right? A rabbi has no magical ability of being a holier, better, or more knowledgeable individual than a learned Jew, which is why the title rabbi doesn't really carry much weight. You know, the person who is a rabbi has effectively, you know, been shown as a teacher, but that doesn't necessarily make them particularly holy. So anyhow, that's a few thoughts kind of off of this concept of hard work. Any reflections or questions? I see Rich has his hand up. Go ahead, Rich.
Very nice discussion, Rabbi, presentation, appreciate it. I do think, though, that maybe the Dalai follows you. I mean, we don't know. Could be. So, but I appreciate your modesty in that regard.
Thank you. He does not follow me on Twitter, but I follow him. I also follow the Pope, which is great. I mean, they're both very, very useful. But I think it's worth asking the question off of Rich's comment, who do we follow and who do we influence, right? We are all a rabbi to somebody, as some of my teachers have taught me. Another piece that goes with that, though, is do we follow them for their accomplishments, right? The work that they achieved, back to our, did you make the beet latkes successfully? Or do you follow them for the hard work that went into it, right? I'm going to be honest, Dee, I made the poached salmon in the dishwasher this week, about a week ago, and this one didn't come out right, right? Something was off, and either I didn't cook it right, or I bought a bad piece of fish or something. But the effort at putting it into the dishwasher is still a holy act. It's very important. By the way, if all of you are not aware, Dee Seligman has a recipe for dishwasher salmon, which I only learned this week is not foolproof, but is overwhelmingly very good from week to week. So you just have to keep making recipes in order to figure it out. Go ahead, Dan. You unmuted, Dan?
Hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. There's a quote. Choose for yourself a good mentor.
Or teacher.
That's the key.
But yeah, right. I think I you're right. The question that we're really asking here is the good mentor the one who works hard? Or is it the one who has accomplished much? And are the two synonymous with one another? Which I think is a really fascinating question.
The question is whether that person can help you. You can look at all his credentials, but is he the one that's going to help you? And I'm not saying how you judge that, but it's not a matter of what he's done, because he could not do, he might do bunkus for you.
Right. I think that gets at a different issue that you say very well, which is, does he help you, right? Which is to say, not every single person is the right rabbi for every single other person, right? You can't teach everybody. Okay, Tanya, go ahead. You have your hand up. Can't hear you.
Okay, I made a comment in the chat. I think that's why we like Cinderella stories, because we like to see people like ourselves, you know, mere mortals, rise to the top. I don't know if you all saw this Indian movie several years ago called Slumdog Millionaire, but it was a boy from the ghetto of, like, India who wants to be a millionaire. And we like to see people like ourselves attain the prize. We like to see mere mortals know that we can get it if we put in enough effort.
It's interesting you bring up Cinderella, because Cinderella is a strange version of that story in the sense that Cinderella, I have kids, so I watch a lot of Disney movies. But remember, the story of Cinderella is she works hard fruitlessly for her wicked stepmother, and the only thing that fixes it is the fairy godmother, right? The fairy godmother magically comes and fixes everything. And I think our story from our Hasidic rabbi, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch, is to say, my father is the Baal Shem Tov. He's the fairy godmother, right? You don't want to go to me. You want to go to Aaron of Karlin. Aaron of Karlin is the story of, if you ever saw it, The Princess and the Frog, the version that Disney just recently did, where the hardworking waitress from New Orleans gets everything she wants through hard work, right? She starts her restaurant because she works hard for it. Go ahead, Tanya.
Well, you know, Joseph is a version of that, too, because he was in two pits. I mean, you know, he was in the pit where his brothers threw him in, and then he was in the pit when he was in that dungeon. And he comes out of that pit to become, like, you know, the head of second only in command to Pharaoh, like the minister of agriculture. And he was the shepherd boy. And what did he know about economics? He didn't go to Harvard Business School. He was a shepherd boy. And to see the shepherd boy dressed in linen, second in command, that's like, wow, you know?
Yeah, you nailed it. I think that's really, it's funny that you mentioned that. You are my teacher in this case, and I am the student. Because I had not connected the Joseph story in any way to this Hasidic comment about the hard work. And it is Joseph who does the hard work. In this case, though, the hard work was previous to that. It was, and in this case, specifically, if you were to be on the micro level, the hard work is resisting Potiphar's wife. Okay, with that, oh, go ahead, Tanya. One last comment.
Just one last comment. You know, I heard a midrash that, you know, his father, when they brought the garment to him that said a wild beast had torn Joseph, that actually Yaakov had a vision of this beast. But the actual beast was a metaphor for Mrs. Potiphar.
Nice. So that, yeah, that sounds like a very medieval rabbinic interpretation, that the sin that Joseph would eventually do had kind of reverse spectrally projected itself backwards in time to the moment at which the wild beast tore his garment. That's really nice. Go ahead, Paula. You wanted to say something?
I was thinking the only thing we didn't touch upon, you could have the guy that's literally born with a silver spoon in his mouth and does absolutely nothing with it, piddles it away, does no good whatsoever. Or you could have the counterpart, the guy that's born with everything, multiplies his wealth, is very philanthropic, studies well, and is a good, honorable person.
Yeah, and I think that's reflected in the text, which is to say, Rabbi Tzvi, we're not meant to understand that Rabbi Tzvi of Pinsk is a bad human being. In fact, he's an incredibly humble individual, so humble that when a person comes to him for his advice, which is, there's another meta piece of wisdom in this text that we hadn't, that Paula, you just pulled out, which is the meta piece of wisdom here is he doesn't say, I'm useless, I can give no advice of moral purpose to anyone. He says, the thing that you come to me asking about, I can't help you with because I'm not the expert. You should really find this other person. So me and Jeremy Marquise were learning a piece of text a couple months ago, and I said to him, like, I don't know what this is. And he goes, yeah, me neither, but I do know the guy that does. And he called up one of his colleagues, Rabbi Marcus. And Marcus knew, I forget Marcus's last name, but Marcus is an expert in Kabbalah. And Marcus knew straight away what the thing was about. So the question is not to, it's not to undermine the idea of a person who inherits their wealth. It's to say a person who inherits his wealth might be valuable and important, but they may not be the right person to go to in all matters. All right. With that, let's move on to our next text. I'm going to share a screen again with you guys. And we're going on. So this is an interesting one from this week's Torah portion. And again, this is the one that we did last week. Last year. Vayosef hu hashalit al haaretz hu hamashbir lekol am haaretz vayavo el ech achei Yosef vishtachavu lo apayim artsa. Now Joseph was the vizier of the land. It was he who dispensed rations to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed low to him with their faces to the ground. So our Hasidic comment is from Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu Taub of Zvolen. His son will become the rabbi of Mudgetz, and the Mudgetz Hasidim still do still have a lot of influence in the Jewish world. In fact, I sang, I led services this last week, and I sang a low, slow El Adon. And if you wanted to know, the El Adon tune that I used is from the Mudgetz Hasidim. So that's the connection to this text. So he says, Joseph the righteous, his insides were not like his outsides. On the outside, he was the vizier, a powerful man, powerful and domineering. However, in his innermost heart, he was shattered and broken. And he is that which is broken. So the move here, and I made a little box down at the bottom, is that the Hebrew word shavar means to break. And it can also mean, in this context, to be the provider. So the text says that Yosef was the mashbir. And the translation that they give for that is, he was the guy who dispensed rations. So there is a department store in Jerusalem, in the center of town, just at the top of Ben Yehuda Street, and it is called Hamashbir Letzor Khan, the provider of all your needs. That's literally the name of the department store, the provider of all your needs. So that's the word mashbir, but shavar can also mean broken. So if you take the word, he is the mashbir, it can be the opposite of the shalit, right? Shalit means powerful, mashbir means broken. So Joseph is this guy who is politically powerful because he's the right-hand man to Pharaoh. He's responsible for handing out all the rations to all the people in Egypt. But he's also broken. So his outsides are not like his insides. He plays the part of having it all together, but deep down inside, he's an emotionally distraught individual, right? And I think that this is an amazing text on human nature. And I mentioned it in Minyan on Sunday, which is that a lot of us kind of walk around pretending like everything's okay. Our friends call us up on Zoom or our family to talk about how we're doing during this pandemic where we're all fairly lonely. And they ask us, how are you doing? And our response is overwhelmingly, fine, how are you? And I would say this with a blue word, but I see that there's a very small face looking at the camera right now. It's not entirely true, right? A lot of us are walking around kind of like very traumatized and sad, and we just pretend like everything's okay. And we don't act like, oh, he left, so I can say bullshit. But it's, you know, sometimes we're not being honest, and I think that's hard. I think it's hard to say, to let down our guard and say, you know what, in month 9 of isolation, I am not doing very well. I miss my mom, right? I miss Mexican food in Los Angeles. I would like to go on vacation. I would like to go to the Natural History Museum. There are so many things that I am without. I would like to hug a friend, right? We talked about this a couple weeks ago. And the question that this text is kind of getting at is, are your insides like your outsides? When is it okay to be powerful and on the outside? And when do we need to let our guard down and be honest and say, like, I'm not doing very well? And the other question that goes with this is, who are we okay letting our guard down around? Who do we feel comfortable with saying, like, I'm not doing great today. I miss my mom, you know? That's a legitimate thing to bring up. All right, any comments on this text before we move along? I will point out we did this one last year. Last year, we were not in a pandemic. So, but I think this text is honestly, this one is universally and repetitively relevant, right? The question that we should ask ourselves all the time is, are my insides like my outsides? And is it okay to put on a mask right now? And when do I take off the mask, right? On some level, that's one of the big questions of Purim. We are wearing a mask to cover ourselves up, but a lot of people at the Purim story say we are actually revealing that which is in our insides, which is normally concealed. So Purim is the time where we reveal that which is concealed. We're pretty far away from Purim, though. Okay, let's do the next. Oh, Tanya has a comment. Go ahead.
Even though he was a broken man on the inside, and one thing I liked about him, he was always crying and always weeping. He embodied that whole concept of tikkun olam, repairing the world. He was broken on the inside, but he was fixing what was wrong in his physical world.
That's a really neat observation, which is not where I was before, but I like it anyways. He didn't let his emotional turmoil affect his job performance, and in this specific case, feeding hungry people. And I think that's a valuable thing to talk about, which is a lot of people who...
And I mean, it was on a global scale.
Right, right. He was feeding, he literally fed people who came from other countries who were hungry. Well said. All right, let's go on to do the last text. Sharing screen one more time. And here we go. Okay, so this one's a little bit long, but it's a pretty good one. So as we go forward in the story, we get this little line. And may El Shaddai dispose the man to mercy toward you, that he may release to you your other brother as well as Benjamin. As for me, if I am to be bereaved, I shall be bereaved. So there's this weird invocation of El Shaddai, and this is in reference to, this is Joseph pretending to his brother Reuven that he is asking for Benjamin to be kind of brought down to Egypt. And we all know that Joseph knows that these 12 guys are his brothers, but his brothers don't recognize him. And so this is all kind of kabuki theater, right? He's just messing around with them. So the question is going to be about the words that are specifically used here, El Shaddai. So why use a specific name of God that's very rarely invoked like El Shaddai here when you could have just as well used Adonai or Elohim, the two much more common uses of God's name? So we get a comment by the Rabbi Mordechai Yosef of Ishbitz, the Meir Shiloach, one of the absolutely great Hasidic rabbis. He would be considered third generation in the Hasidic tree. Ishbitz is kind of modern, I think, Ukraine. And he says this, and according to the Midrash, the one who said to the world enough, El Shaddai, Dai in Hebrew is enough, as you all know from the Passover story, Dai Dai Enu, right? So El Shaddai is God, the God name that is God who said enough. Okay, to one who said to the world, enough, has said enough to my struggle. And that's Rashi's comment. Our rabbis taught on the name Shaddai that the world at the hour of creation expanded and proceeded until God said enough. And Rabbi Bunim of Pshisicha said that the purpose of the creation of the world was so that living beings would recognize the greatness of Hashem Yisborach, the blessed name. Thus it was said, enough, such that the creation up until now, it is enough already to be brought to one's lips in acknowledgement of Hashem. And this is why Jacob mentions the specific name Shaddai here. For suffering also brings the Holy One, blessed be, to humankind, in order to polish it and cause a recognition to the Creator. And Jacob said, enough, the tsuras that I have gone through till now are enough to bring me to recognize the Creator of all. So the question kind of coming here is, what disposes a person to mercy? And the response that the Meir Shiloach is giving is, the thing that creates in a person a feeling of mercy is a feeling of knowing enough, right? Saying, I have reached my limit of suffering, I can suffer no more. And now I understand the suffering of other people, right? to some degree, this is to say, when a person is, a person doesn't understand how to be compassionate towards others until they themselves have suffered, right? Until they have reached a very, very trying time in their life, they cannot understand it. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that I had a experience in which a traumatic experience created PTSD. And I kind of dealt with PTSD in my life for about a year. And to that end, if a person tells me that they've experienced trauma, I can understand it, right? I can kind of not necessarily stand literally in their shoes, but stand near to their shoes, right? And I think that that's a valuable idea that we are kind of looking at in this text, which is empathy and mercy and understanding is a process for human beings of experiencing trouble oneself. That doesn't mean all of us should experience trouble in order to be more empathetic, but it does recognize that people have a breaking point, and that when you are at your breaking point, you say die, you say enough, you are speaking to a specific emanation of the Holy One Blessed Be. And that specific emanation is the El Shaddai, the God who says enough. The merciful divine being who comes down at the point at which a human being has reached their absolute limit of suffering and says, I understand, I see now that you understand, and we have reached our limit. It's an interesting text. I don't know, this one could definitely be read in other ways which are more problematic. But I do think that there's a lot of value to reflecting on this idea of standing in another person's shoes with empathy. Any final comments for the day for you guys on this text? Tanya, go ahead.
Okay, you know, Rabbi, this brings to mind when Esther says, if I perish, I perish. Because, you know, God, even though God's name is not mentioned in the English version of the book of Esther, Mordecai kind of had to remind her that you're one of us. And if you don't help us, you know, our deliverance may come from somewhere else. And just those words, if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved, it just reminds me of when Esther said, if I perish, I perish. And in my mind, I'm kind of making the connections between those two. I know it sounds a little off topic, but in my mind, it's the same statement.
Yes, I agree. I think you're right. They're the exact same emotional state, and they reflect in different directions, right? It's when you've reached your breaking point, when you say enough, it's enough, it's enough. There's nothing more that I can do. And that point at which a person reaches their breaking point, for Esther, it was, I've reached my breaking point, and that means whatever happens, happens, right? I can do no more. I cannot change my situation. It's in the Talmud and in the Torah, there's this concept which is really interesting. The Hebrew word is Yeush, and Yeush literally translates as despair. But Yeush is a sense of despair in not a pejorative necessarily context, but Yeush can mean an acceptance after the fact that there is nothing more that can be done, right? Having Yeush on a thing, as they say in modern Hebrew or even in kind of the Talmudic world, is to say, que sera, sera, whatever will be. Like, there's nothing more that I can do in this case, and I have done enough. Back to our original topic, it's part of that working thing, right? When you work really hard on something, and you also recognize, like, there is nothing more I can do to make this program, this activity, this class, to make this food, to make this building better, right? The architect has done all the work. It's up to the engineer now. And if the engineers and the construction guys screw up on reading my blueprints, there's nothing I can do. Renee, go ahead. And then Joe.
It comes down to the basic tenets of negotiation. You want a win-win situation. But there's also a piece of it to know when to walk away, when to say this is not going to work, and not beat yourself up, but understand that it just didn't work.
Right. Right. I think, right, the idea that my son and I played Monopoly last night, so I know the feeling. You walk away from a bad deal. You got to say, but it's also you walk away from a situation which just can't get any better. It's well said. Joe, go ahead, and then Rabbi Judy.
I wanted to get back to El Shaddai, rarely used word, problematic word for God in Torah. Why did Joseph use that name? So maybe we asked the wrong, and we got a very complicated explanation, but I think there are simpler explanations. I mean, he couldn't use the typical Jewish names or Hebrew names because that would have compromised his position as Joseph, the son of Jacob. But why did he not use one of the well-recognized Egyptian names for God? Like the Atan. So he picked a word for God, which is not easy to understand, and may have had kind of like a diffuse use throughout the entire area in those days. Why did he pick that word, which kind of hints that maybe he isn't everything that he claims to be, an Egyptian?
Joe's doing his Joe thing, which I like, which is to say Joe's really interested in the what's called the pshat explanation. The pshat explanation is the literal explanation. Like he wants to know in situ, inside the story, why pick El Shaddai. So the best answer I can give you on that, which may not be satisfying, is the other places where El Shaddai is used are with Abraham. Abraham calls to El Shaddai at least once or twice. And we also know, a lot of you probably know this, but we also know that one of the central questions in the book of Exodus is kind of, it's a Nixonian Watergate type question. What did he know and when did he know it? The question in Exodus is, do the Israelites know God's name? Does Moses know God's name, and when do they know it, right? And that's this big moment in the beginning in the Exodus 2 story of God revealing God's name to Moses. I'm going to tell you my name, right? That's a big deal. And there's for biblical scholars, that's a big debate. And the big names that are used here are the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh name and the Elohim name. And so to Joe's point, You nailed it, Joe. Your question is half the answer, which is he can't use the Adonai name. He can't use the Elohim name because the brothers would have said, the jig is up, right? I know exactly. You must be a Hebrew, right? And by Hebrew, I mean my brother because that's the only Hebrew out there. El Shaddai, I think, there's a small logical idea to it, which is maybe Joseph was thinking to himself, I'm going to throw out a name of God that my brothers don't know because only Abraham knew it. But why does Joseph know the name El Shaddai? Because the Torah never tells us that Abraham tells Isaac, tells Jacob, tells Joseph this other name. So I don't have a good answer for you. But I think your question is excellent. My answer for you is, this is the Midrashic one, which is they specifically use El Shaddai because they're interested in this brilliant move of talking about when we are fed up and our emotional capabilities of empathizing with others. All right, Rabbi Judy, go ahead. Oh, go ahead, Joe.
I had half the answer right, but I think you got the other half of the answer too. And we need a little time to think that we now have the full answer.
Thanks. So the last thing I'll say on that is the phrase, I use the word pshat, and pshat is, like I said, it is the literal. So in the rabbinic world, in the Jewish world, we generally think of four levels of interpretation. That's semi-artificial because I got to be honest, I think like levels 2 and 3 are roughly interchangeable, but they don't make for a pretty acronym. So there are four levels of Jewish interpretation according to tradition: the pshat, the remez, the drash, and the sod. If you take the first letter of each of those words, you get pardes. And a pardes is a orchard. But it's also the English root of the word paradise, meaning the Garden of Eden. So a person who can translate and interpret all four levels of a verse of Torah has reached the pinnacle, you know, has reached the highest of the highs. The reason that I think it's semi-artificial is I have yet to meet a rabbi who has ever really pulled apart the difference between the remez and the drash. Now, the drash is what rabbis give in sermons, right? Which is they pull out a meaning which is not necessarily there, but they spin it, right? Whenever Seth, Rabbi Adelson, gives a sermon in synagogue where he applies the Trump administration and the coronavirus and the pandemic response to this week's Torah portion, that's a drash, right? You're pulling something out by, you know, moving two steps away in order to make the point. The remez is the hinted meaning, but it's really roughly the same as the drash. The sod is that final level, and that is Kabbalah. And to this class, which is a class in Hasidic interpretations of the weekly Torah portion, the Hasidic interpretation is roughly an attempt at accessing the sod for the common man and saying a mystical, you know, crazy understanding of the Godhead in situ from its transcendent place above us is truly accessible to human beings. Although the true, true sod is that inaccessible, which is truly inaccessible. Go ahead, Joe.
With the information you supplied, here's an answer which I think is very consistent with the rest of today's storyline, plot line. So he can't use the regular name for God, the Hebrew name for God. He doesn't want to use the Egyptian name for God. So he uses El Shaddai. If it was known to Joseph, it was known to Jacob's other brothers. And the reason why he uses it is because he's conflicted.
Yeah, that's nice.
Being the key word there.
That's nice. Rabbi Judy, go ahead.
Just to back about Akhenaten, is that, do you use that name for God? That came later. That Akhenaten tried to usurp and change the Egyptians' religion to the religion of one God. And Freud in Moses and Monotheism posited that Moses was a follower of Akhenaten, that he was an Egyptian and he was a follower of Akhenaten, but he could have been a Jew and just seen that. But that whole movement towards monotheism was defeated and quashed. So I don't think the idea of Akhenaten as the one God existed at the time of Joseph. I'd be very surprised if that was so. I think that was a political religious movement that came around the time of Moses. But when we were talking before about doing everything you could, and before Joe got into this whole fascinating discussion, and you, Rabbi, we were talking about recognizing that you've done everything that you could, and then you have to let it be and move on. You didn't use those words, but I think it's the same meaning, and I think that is a sign of maturity. And to give a drash, I don't see that our president or a lot of the Republicans seem to be able to have gotten to that point. They did everything they could. They tried their best. They lost.
Yeah.
So that's a drash, I guess.
Right.
But I think maturity is what you were talking about.
Interesting.
You do everything you can. It isn't that you're defeated. You are just mature enough to accept the reality of what has happened.
Right. It's you do the work and you say that you do the work and you say that it's enough. But they're both important steps, right? The first commentary was about doing the work and then seeking advice from people who do the work. The last commentary was about accepting the results and saying it's enough. You know, I am enough. Or I have suffered enough. And it's time to use my suffering in a way which can be reflective towards other people, or to move on in that case. All right, that's all the time we have for this week. It was great seeing you guys. I finished 3 minutes early, or, you know, 12 minutes late, depending on who you ask. I hope you guys are all well. Do not get on the roads today. Do not go anywhere. Not that we've really been going anywhere for the last several months, but, you know, if you want to go into your backyard and make snow angels, I would highly advise that. Joe, you definitely need to put on, you know, warm clothes to do that, though. Joe Charney. Because I know that, Joe, you're at 93 years old, really into snow angels. Yeah.
No, I won't be 93 till New Year's Eve.
Sorry. Oh, is that true? You're turning 93?
No, New Year's Eve. That's when I get.
That's right. That's exciting.
That's exciting.
93 is a big one.
Yeah. It's all threes.
It's good. All right, everybody, have a great day. If you guys want to, I'm going to leave the room open. So if you guys want to. Oh, good. I'm going to keep the room open, so don't worry.
Have a good day.
Yeah, Rana.